family. This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today has just returned from a business trip which involved tracking wild tigers in Thailand and Indonesia. We're talking this hour with Alan Rabinowitz, a renowned zoologist, conservationist, and CEO of Panthera, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the world's big cats. Rabinowitz will be in New Hampshire on Saturday, speaking at the Squam Lakes Natural Science Center. He'll talk about the threats these felines face, from poachers and loss of habitat, and Rabinowitz will describe his group's efforts to save them, an approach he says emphasizes the whole ecosystem, including local people who may come into conflict with these cats, for example, when a lion kills a villager's livestock, or when expanding the local economy might mean building where the animals roam. Here in New Hampshire, obviously, we don't have these issues, but wild cats here have also made news, with bobcat populations rising and continued reports from Granite Staters who swear they saw a cougar out in the woods. Today in The Exchange, protector of the world's wild cats, Alan Rabinowitz, joins us from New York. And let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Alan Rabinowitz, it's so great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, which big cats are you focused on, Alan, and where are they?
Well, my organization, Panthera, is focused on all the wild cats, with an emphasis on the largest of the cats, which are tiger, lion, jaguar, snow leopard, leopard. I personally have spent my career focusing on two of those species, the jaguar and the tiger. And that's what I do most of my work on, and the people that I work with work on the other cats.
And which of these cats would you say, Alan, is in the most trouble?
Oh, there's no question about it, sadly. The cat that's in the most dire shape is the tiger. The tiger has lost about 98% of its historic habitat.
Wow, 98%.
We're down to just literally a few thousand, about 3,000 left in the wild. It's very sad.
Why is that, Alan? Why so much the tiger in Asia?
Well, the tiger more than any other, because the tiger is in huge demand. It's economics. The tiger's parts are hugely valued in the Asian medicinal trade, especially the Chinese medicinal trade. It's a form of medicine that dates back over 5,000 years. It's got a lot of great things to it, which the Western world has utilized. But a part of Chinese medicine utilizes parts of animals. And some of the most powerful of those medicines are the parts of tigers.
Wow. You know, I saw that on your website, and I was kind of surprised, Alan, because I would have expected, you know, big cats would be threatened by encroachment on their habitat or pollution or climate change, and we'll definitely talk about that because I know that's huge. But yeah, talk a little bit more about this, if you could. Threatened by old-fashioned poaching, really. I mean, give us a little more, if you could. Who's killing these wild cats and why? It seems so old school, you know? Poaching.
Old
I mean, it seems
school.
Like from
that's
the 1960s.
Yeah, that's never going to go away. The cats, all the large cats especially, are in fact threatened by exactly what you say. Loss of habitat, increasing human population, increasing pressures on the land, the killing of either the cats themselves, or more importantly, even when people don't hunt the cats, local people often kill the wildlife that the cats need to feed upon, and that's just like putting a bullet in the cat. So the populations will disappear because of lack of food. But the reason that the tiger numbers have plummeted so much faster than the others, part of it is because they live in a part of the world with the largest number of people in Asia. The tigers occupy now much of Asia. Many of the tiger races have gone extinct already. Several kinds of tigers, like the Caspian tiger and the Balinese tiger and the Javan tiger, South China tiger, those are all distinct subspecies which are now gone from the wild. But there are still some tigers left in very small populations, and they're under great threat, even with a lot of protection put towards them and money put towards them, because their parts, in particular certain parts, like their bones, are more valuable than almost any precious metal, any illegal drug, any gem. They're highly valued. Tiger bone is highly valued in Chinese medicine. People will say, well, that's crazy. Now, it's not crazy. It's folklore. It's Chinese medicine is highly efficacious in many ways, especially the plants you used in Chinese medicine. The animal parts, however, a lot of it is based on the qi, the life force of the animal, and that component adds to the medicine and can address certain kinds of ailments that Western medicine can't get at, such as rheumatism and arthritis, that kind of thing.
I have a couple more questions for you specifically on the tigers, Alan, but let me also invite our listeners to join us. The number here in the exchange for you to be part of our conversation with Alan Rabinowitz is 1-800-892-6477. This hour in the exchange, we're looking at his work, Saving the World's Wild Cats. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And by the way, on our Facebook page, you can see some beautiful, beautiful pictures of some of these wild cats. We've also put some information up about Alan Rabinowitz's trip to New Hampshire this weekend. He'll be speaking in the Lakes region. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Just a couple more questions about the tigers, Alan, and then so many other cats that I want to ask you about. So this is what's interesting to me about your organization, is that you're trying to approach this with some cultural sensitivity, working with local people where these animals still live in the wild and saying, hey, please help us out here. I mean, I think someone on one of your videos says local people really hold the key to these animals' continued wild existence. So how do you go into Thailand and Indonesia, where you just were a couple days ago, and say to folks there, look, don't kill these cats. Don't take the money from the Chinese medicine company that wants you to kill them and take their bones and so forth. Don't do this. How do you sort of even begin that conversation and convince them to see things your way?
Part of that job is done for me. Interestingly enough, almost every single village I have ever traveled to, almost every government official I've ever spoken to, they all want to see their wildlife, and in particular, their big cats and big animals protected. They don't want to lose them. They're a very important part of their culture, of their life, of what they feel is the value of their land. Local people often get it. They understand that the tiger adds something to their lives and livelihood. However, they don't want to be economically impacted by it. They want tigers or jaguars or other big cats, but they don't want to be losing cattle or dogs or be fearful of their child's life if they go and collect water at
sure.
a stream. So it's a matter of It's not so much a matter of me convincing them why these animals are important to live, but of finding out ways of mitigating how much problem or any problems that these animals might cause, or adding value to the people's lives because they are choosing or allowing themselves to live with these big cats. So we give them, people who live in Tiger Range or Jaguar Range may then get special scholarships or have programs associated with medical care and better schooling, things they want for their children, because they're living with the tigers. Or we'll have programs of helping them build better corrals, helping them manage livestock better, sometimes reimbursing them for lost livestock. They want to live with these cats. They know they can, more than we know. But they don't want to be economically impacted, nor do they want to live in fear.
So making it economically beneficial to live side by side with these cats, there must be a tourism draw too, right, Alan? I mean, people like to
see
these animals.
Tourism isn't the end all to everything. People think tourism will always solve the tourists only want to go to certain areas. So you really have to have a very special area for tourism to have a huge economic impact. So tourism is one of the tools in the toolbox we use, but it's by no means the end of the result.
That's interesting. It sounds like you get that question a lot.
A lot, yes. And every ranch, every place I travel to, whether it's in Lion Range or Jaguar Range or Snow Leopard Range, they say, how about tourism? Well, would a tourist want to come into your backyard? I mean, every place is not suitable for tourism. Nor is tourism always good, because sometimes when ecotourism turns just into money tourism, greed tourism, then it ends up having a negative impact on both the cats and the people.
That's interesting. So some places may say to you, Alan, we don't want to become a tiger tourist destination. We want to do this a different way.
That's right. In fact, many places say that.
And that's where the other incentives come in. Better corrals for the livestock. More education about where to go and where not to go when it comes to...
Well, and especially things which all the families want the same thing we want. They want better lives for their children. That's what they want more than anything. They don't want color TV sets or bigger homes. They want their children to have a good life. So that boils down to usually education and health programs. So we often partner with different medical facilities and different organizations. We had a partnership, in fact, with Mount Sinai in New York, so that we can link conservation of the big cats with health facilities or school facilities.
All right. We will talk more after a very short break. Moving on from the tigers to a couple of the other big cats that your group's been working with, Alan. And we'll take your questions and comments, too. Join us. Again, our guest this hour is Alan Rabinowitz, CEO of Panthera, an organization dedicated to saving the world's big cats. We'd love your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. We'll be back in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for news you won't find anywhere else. And click over now to read Emily Corwin's reporting on why New Hampshire corrections officers are working forced overtime and what that's costing the state. Your essential source for news and information is at NHPR.org. Partly to mostly cloudy today, chance of some scattered showers and thunderstorms. Some may have gusty winds and small hail. Highs today, mid to upper 70s. Partly cloudy tonight with a chance of scattered showers and thunderstorms in the evening. Lows tonight in the lower 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Tory Hill Author Series presenting Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game on Saturday, August 9th at 7 p.m., Warner Town Hall. Details at warnerhistorical.org. And EnviroVantage of Epping, providing disaster recovery services for industrial, commercial, and residential clients, including mold removal created by flood damage. EnviroVantage.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about efforts to save the world's big wild cats. Our guest is Alan Rabinowitz. He's a zoologist, conservationist, field biologist, and the CEO of Panthera, an organization devoted to preserving big cats and their ecosystems around the globe. You can find details about his appearance at Squam Lake's Natural Science Center at our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now, too, with your questions and comments about the wild cats of the world, where they live, what threats they face. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Alan, let's go to our listeners now. And Chris is joining us from Kittery, Maine. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Good morning, Laura. Good morning, Alan.
Morning.
My question for you, Alan, is in order to preserve the big cats, like tigers, is there anywhere in the world that they could be relocated to a safe environment from them, for them, like say an island where they'd be allowed to breed and hunt and let the numbers increase without fear of human involvement or hunting or anything like that?
Yeah, it's actually an interesting question, Chris. Thank you very much. A sort of special protected place where they could hunt and breed and thrive. What do you think, Alan?
That's a really, really good question. In fact, it's been done. It's been tried with the tiger, taking them to a place in South Africa and breeding them up in a controlled environment in a fenced area in South Africa. That works. It works fine, but then what you have basically is you have a safari park, you have a zoo. What the goal even was on that project was eventually to try to breed up tigers and reintroduce them back into their natural habitat. What the good news is that although there's only 3,000 or so tigers left in fragmented areas, there's a lot more tiger habitat. There's a lot of habitat out there within tiger range, which used to have tigers and doesn't have tigers anymore. So instead of having to actually take them where they don't live, what we can and are trying to do is to try to protect some of these areas where they've been wiped out, try to bring the prey back, and possibly either let them spread naturally back into those areas or actually relocate them. Relocation of some of these big cats is becoming a very cutting-edge activity that we're thinking about. But in order to relocate animals into any area, you've got to make sure that the primary threats are gone from that area. If you just lock it up with a fence or basically you're creating just a safari park, and that's easy to do. We can put them in a safari. Tigers are not going to go extinct. We've got several thousand tigers in captivity. We have over 3 to 4 times more tigers in captivity right now in the world than we do in the wild. The issue is not that tigers will be gone from the face of the earth. The issue is that possibly wild tigers might be gone from the face of the earth.
Well, so this is a really important question. Chris, thank you very much for calling in. So why is this so important, Alan, this idea of keeping wild cats in their natural habitat? Why is that key?
Well, it gets to the issue of why do we need natural habitat at all? Why do we need wildness? Why do we need all the components of a truly wild area with what's called the apex predators, which is what a tiger is, the top of the food chain? And there are many answers to this. Part of it, let's totally stay away from the fact that these animals have a right to exist, which I feel very strongly about. But on a purely practical level, these healthy ecosystems with the wildlife that they have in it, not just an empty forest, these places are firewalls. What is happening right now with Ebola? What has been happening in the past with SARS, with West Nile virus, with many of these reemerging zoonotic diseases? These are not new things. These have been in the environment for a long, long time. Part of what protects human society from diseases in the environment that just don't go away is this firewall of the natural world. And that's not emphasized enough. Scientists realize that, but they don't talk about that enough. Having a wild natural world with everything up to the top predators that control other animals in the forest is actually very crucial to human welfare and human health.
That's pretty profound, isn't it? It's huge.
Well, it's very important, and we're trying to get scientists to be able to talk more about this to people in a way that people can understand. There's even with the issue of climate change, part of why I think there's such a large proportion of society that doesn't either get or believe in climate change is because the science is not being clarified well enough. Scientists in the scientific world are not bringing it to the people in a popular way that really should be done, so that people understand. People are not scientists. They need to be explained why these things are really happening. People should know, why do we really need tigers and jaguars? That's a valid question. It's not just that they're beautiful and that they have a right to exist. What is it about their existence that helps our existence? And those links can be made.
Given that key point, you know, the idea that preserving natural habitat isn't just important because we all love to watch the video of the snowy leopard bounding through the snow, how do you feel as an organization about this idea of relocation that our caller asks about? I'm wondering if that's controversial. You know, no, let's not relocate. Let's do this very important work that not only saves the cats, but maybe even saves humanity.
It's been somewhat it's not controversial. It's that it's been somewhat ignored by the scientific world, including by myself, frankly. And I've started changing my opinions about this. The reason being that in most of these cases, the animals breed very well. They're not like rhinos and some other species, which actually have a tough time breeding under stressful environments or just breeding normally in the wild. These animals, cats breed well. We all know that. If they're just protected, then the populations actually come back, and in fact, that they spread. And one of the things we're really learning about big cats is how they can move through the human landscape and, in fact, spread over large areas to other wild areas. So the cats, we haven't thought about relocation because in order to do it right is incredibly expensive and takes many, many years. But it can be done often. But the fact is, we often don't need – that's kind of what people see as a quick fix when it's not a quick fix whatsoever, when, in fact, we can still get at the same end result if we just go into better law enforcement, actually abide by what the laws say in these countries and protect these animals where they exist.
Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Again today in the exchange, our guest is Alan Rabinowitz. He's CEO of a group called Panthera, an organization devoted to preserving wild cats around the world and their ecosystems, as we're hearing. 1-800-892-6477, again, is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We welcome your questions and comments about these big cats and efforts around the world to preserve them. 1-800-892-6477. And Alan Rabinowitz, I couldn't help but hear in the background there, I don't know if our listeners heard it, a dog. Do you own domestic cats? I have to ask.
Oh, I knew that one did that. One. I own a dog. I own a rescue dog, and I would love to own cats, but I do not because I'm allergic to cats. I have been allergic to cats my entire life. When people say, why do you love cats so much more than other animals? I actually don't love cats more than other animals, but I do love cats. I use the big cats in order to save all the animals, but I'm allergic to them. Even when I work on wild cats, such as jaguars and tigers, I have to take antihistamine so that I don't swell up.
So one of the world's leading experts on wild cats is actually allergic.
Yes, that's right. It's not a very well-kept secret.
Well, here's an email that came in from Rick in Berlin. He says, Laura, please have your guests talk about mountain lions in New Hampshire. Now, we'll talk more about your other efforts around the globe, especially your efforts in South America and Africa. But let's talk a little bit more locally, if we could, Alan. So thanks for the email, Rick. What about mountain lions in New Hampshire? There are always, always, always reports that people have seen mountain lions, and then the wildlife officials in the state say, no, 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 there aren't any. What's your take on this, Alan?
Well, this is talk about a controversial question. This is an interesting one, and it's one I have a little familiarity with because I happen to live about 60 miles north of New York City on a mountaintop of 25 acres that's connected to thousands of other acres. And I myself have followed up on numerous reports of mountain lion sightings and looked at lots and lots of tracks. And what I feel is that I do agree that what they call the Eastern Mountain Lion, which I believe that genetically is pretty well accepted now to be all part of the same species, the mountain lion of North America, of the United States. But the populations that used to live in the East and in the Northeast were probably eradicated, if not fully eradicated, virtually eradicated, to where breeding went down to almost zero. Could there have been tiny pockets that survived? Yes, there could have been with mountain lions, because they're capable of surviving on some very, very small prey. But the evidence is pretty good, given what happened to the Northeast United States, that breeding mountain lion populations that used to live here were pretty much wiped out or just disappeared. Now, having said that, I am absolutely convinced, well, it's not just me convinced, but we now have evidence, we have solid data points that some of the mountain lion sightings in the Northeast have been valid, especially in 2011 when that mountain lion got killed in Connecticut by a car and genetically was traced back to the Dakotas. This is what I was saying earlier. One of the things we are just now learning and starting to understand about the dispersal of large cats is that large cats, some species more than others, are very, very good at moving over large areas secretively, quietly, through the human landscape without people even knowing about them. This is the whole basis of what I work on for the Jaguar Corridor and what we're doing with the Tiger Corridor. We know that mountain lions have been spreading. The populations out west are doing extremely well. They have been spreading into the Midwest. We know that. We know that they've been into Nebraska and Missouri and Wisconsin. There is absolutely no doubt that some of those mountain lions have spread into the Northeast. So if someone tells me, someone reputable says, I saw a mountain lion, and actually describes what looks like a mountain lion, is that possible? I say it is possible. Now, I've also seen many people who don't know what mountain lions look like mistake bobcats for mountain lions, or they read tracks wrong. Tracks are difficult. Dog tracks, coyote tracks can look similar to mountain lion, though they are
really
distinctive.
That's interesting. Two completely different species.
So it is possible. There is possibility. What I don't know, what I can answer, and that people really want to know, is there a breeding population? Are they breeding here in the Northeast? And to my knowledge, no one has shown solid data of there being breeding, whether it be a photograph of a young wild mountain lion, something like that.
So
I don't know. But are they spreading here? Absolutely, they are spreading here.
And we all hear the stories about, you know, mountain lions out west. In fact, famously, there was a jogger in Colorado a bunch of years ago that was killed on his morning jog by a mountain lion. But I'm fascinated to hear you say that, you know, we know that they've been spreading, you know, and roaming as they do Nebraska. I mean, I'm picturing a mountain lion roaming through the cornfields of Nebraska. How do we know, Alan? I mean, if people hit them with their cars and then they're brought in for ID, or how do we know?
We know now in a way that we couldn't have known in the past, because there's been and this has been a phenomenal development in the field of wildlife conservation and in my work with the big cats. We now have new genetic tools. We have DNA fingerprinting. We're able to actually take samples of whether it be live animals, dead animals, or even long dead skins that are in museums. And we can now trace those animals, those individuals, using their DNA to where what other populations they might have originated from, who they might be related to, all of these different kinds of things that we can do with our own DNA.
Wow.
This is a phenomenal tool that is now being used, genetic fingerprinting, and it's one we use heavily at Panthera in conjunction with the American Museum of Natural History in New York.
All right. Well, Rick and Berlin, thank you for that email about mountain lions in New Hampshire. You can email us, too, at exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. By the way, on our Facebook page, we have gorgeous pictures of some of the wildcats that Panthera works with. You can give us a call, too. Your questions and comments about wildcats, whether here in New England or around the world, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So we've been talking a lot, Alan, about how cats roam and wildlife corridors and so forth. And you've been working on those. I think you helped create a huge wildlife corridor stretching from Mexico to Argentina. How do those work? How do we know that wildlife will use them?
Okay, that's a great question. Now, let me explain that this is not a roaming phenomenon. This is what's called dispersal. This is when a young cat, usually males more than females, but both. When a young male and female reaches a certain age, the mother that has been so protective of it up until that age, in order to make sure it survives and feeds well and learns how to hunt, all of a sudden becomes fairly aggressive and starts chasing it away, because now that cat, especially bigger males, become a threat to it in terms of backbreeding, in terms of breeding or mating with its own mother. The mother starts getting aggressive. Something clicks in the cat's head that now it has to leave home. It's kind of similar to us kicking out our teenager from their house, saying, look, it's about time
right. You
went on your own. And they realize that their parent is serious and they have to go out on their own. And that cat takes off. It will often travel hundreds of miles. It'll go away. This is all evolved out of an evolutionary mandate so that the cats don't backbreed with each other, don't interbreed with each other.
So they have to do this to survive.
The cats that don't do it would eventually be taken out of the population because they would be inbreeding too much. So this is a mandate, and they just take off. They disperse. Females often don't have to disperse that far because they're not that kind of a threat, although you still don't want them having related breeding. But the males have to really go.
And, Alan, I'm going to ask you more about your work. I'll ask you about that in just a moment. I want to hear about the Jaguar Corridor in South America, and we'll take more of your calls right back in a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, from the Chesapeake Bay to the Great Lakes, the effects of poisonous algae on the nation's water supply, then concerns about new part-time work trends and proposed remedies, all coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners and from Cedar Crest Center for Children's and Disabilities, comprehensive medical care and education for children with complex medical and developmental needs, ages infant to 21, cedarcrestcenter.org. And Bergeron Technical Services, building and fire code specialists, building information, modeling, design, and project administration throughout New Hampshire, bergerontechnical.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, Alan Rabinowitz is with us. He's an international expert on saving the world's wild cats. His group is called Panthera. He'll be speaking in New Hampshire this weekend, and you can get more information on that on our website, nhpr.org. You can join us now with your thoughts, questions, comments about efforts to preserve the habitats and the populations of wild cats in the world. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange at nhpr.org. And Alan, sorry I had to cut you off there. We were talking about the necessity of these young adult cats to roam. They need to roam. If they stay too close to home, they'll inbreed, and obviously that's not good for the species health. So go ahead, if you could finish up there, about how they use these corridors to help them accomplish this important evolutionary goal.
Well, these are what we call genetic corridors. They, believe it or not, they don't necessarily have to be. The ideal would be them roaming through nice forested land in order to get to a new area where there's a new population and they can breed with new individuals. But sometimes they will roam, if they have to, through the human landscape, through cattle ranches, through citrus groves, through just woodlands in people's backyards, as the mountain lions do in San Francisco. So they will go, and that's why people often don't even know that they're around. People wonder, well, how can there be mountain lions if we never see them? I wonder how many people have ever seen a bobcat, and we know that there's quite a few of those around. Cats are very, very secretive. They're solitary. They don't want to be around people generally. And when they're dispersing in these genetic corridors, even though they might be moving through your backyard and even sleeping under your deck, which we have known mountain lions to do.
Really?
Yes. It happened out in San Francisco. Oh. There was a mountain lion actually bearing young under someone's deck.
Oh, my gosh.
And they didn't think there were any mountain lions around in their area. And we were kind of torn between telling them that there was a mountain lion under their house, which we knew would soon be gone, and scaring them versus not telling them. In the end, we did have to tell them, but we also watched the situation. But they can be around without you knowing them. And that's the key to how big cats can live with people, because they can both share the human landscape. People have to be aware of it, have to be tolerant of it, and just not kill them. And the animals will more or less usually stay on their own and not bother people.
So how do these corridors work? Is it sort of, you know, you've got one wildlife preserve and then you build sort of a nice grassy or forested path to the next wildlife preserve? Is that the goal?
That's an interesting question, because the corridors, generally, we don't have to make them. With tigers, we have to be a bit more proactive and possibly do some reforestation or corridor rehabilitation. But in general, the corridors are just where these animals are moving through right now. What we have to do is identify them, actually figure out where these animals are actually traveling using camera traps, using genetic analysis from their feces that we find. Once we do that, we can talk to the governments and actually zone. Still, that land is still private. That land can still be developed, but it's actually zoned in a certain way as part of the Jaguar Corridor, so that maybe you can have any kind of development, but maybe not a huge dam that blocks off everything, or a four-lane highway. And then even if you do have a four-lane highway or a big dam project, as we're dealing with in parts of Central America with jaguars, as long as we know that the jaguars are moving through there, a red flag goes up in the database of the government, and we can then go in and identify where an alternate corridor would be for those cats so that it's not broken. So we become proactive before the development happens. And believe it or not, governments love this. Developers love it, because they don't then have to fight these huge environmental battles.
Sure.
Or pay large sums of money, because they could actually mitigate prior to development.
I'm just picturing you guys saying, hey, cats, don't take this path, take this other path.
No, we don't have to tell that. That's the beauty of it. Cats have been around 4 million years or more. Homo sapiens have been around 200,000 years. They predate us quite a bit, and they're incredibly indomitable, and they know what to do. We don't have to help them much. We just have to leave them alone.
Well, it's interesting. And just to let you know, Alan, a couple weeks ago, we covered briefly on our show a study from UNH, and UNH researchers are looking at whether New Hampshire's highways are preventing the return of the bobcat. There's a genetic study underway now here in New Hampshire to determine if man-made and natural barriers are limiting the otherwise successful return of the bobcat. So it's kind of interesting that they're worried about inbreeding.
That's a very relevant study. In fact, we found with jaguars, when we radio collared them, that even though they could cross a road very, very easily, they would often come up to the side of a road and turn back for no obvious reason. So while it's not a clear barrier and they should be able to cross, it still does have an effect on them.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us, our conversation with Alan Rabinowitz, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Alan, Diane's waiting in Kentucook. Hi, Diane. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Well, hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a quick comment. I hope my brother is going to call in. My brother, who is a recently retired teacher in the state of New Hampshire, spotted a mountain lion crossing the road in Ware, New Hampshire. He did not get a picture of the animal, but afterwards took a picture or two or three of the paw print that it left. And there's no doubt in my mind. But I hope he'll call in. I told him about your show.
If he doesn't call in, Diane, I want to ask you, did he send that photo of the paw print for identification somewhere? Or
no, I told him he should call the Audubon, but he didn't. I don't think he has yet. But anyway, you'll have to quiz him on that.
All right. Thank you very much for calling in, Diane. I appreciate it. Now, we talked about this earlier, Alan, but I'd love to ask you a little bit more. I mean, there you are in New York. You're not right in New York City. You're 60 miles away. But you said earlier that, you know, there's evidence or hints of mountain lions in your area even, which is amazing to me.
There is, and I've been taken to a track. I've been shown, we have very close to us the largest state park in New York, Fonstock State Park, and I have been shown a track that I have no doubt is a mountain lion track, and I know a mountain lion. Tracks are very, very difficult to tell often in the wild, but there's very clear differences between a dog track, meaning dog or coyote, or a cat track. Very clear differences if you know what to look for and if it's a good track. This was a clear cat track, and it was too large for a bobcat. It looked very much like a typical mountain lion track. Now, what I've often heard, and I don't know why this comes up so often, is people will say, the government agencies will say, well, yes, we know there have been mountain lions, but they're probably released animals. And yet I know that some people, for some strange reason, keep tigers as pets or keep leopards or jaguars as pets. No one has yet shown me evidence of anybody in these areas keeping mountain lions as pets. If you think these are released animals, where would they possibly be released from? So I'm not convinced that these would be released animals for the most part. Again, I don't think that there's any doubt that mountain lions are spreading into the Northeast and occasionally make their way into the Northeast. So if somebody says, I am sure I saw one, I wouldn't just dismiss it. However, I'm not convinced yet because dispersing animals doesn't mean that they can actually form a breeding population. So I'm not sure if there's any population of mountain lions actually breeding and bearing young in the Northeast at this time. Would I be shocked if I was shown evidence? No, I wouldn't.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Alan, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, you co-founded Panthera in 2006, your work around the world with jaguars and tigers and snow leopards and so forth. How long have you been working in this field of conservation, you know, outside of Panthera in 2006? How long have you been doing the kind of work that you do with wild animals?
I actually started working with the Wildlife Conservation Society based at the Bronx Zoo about 30 years ago.
Yeah, so you've been in this field for a long time.
So I've been doing this a little over 30 years. I hate to age myself, but that's about what it was. But my love of this, my desire to try to help animals, started in my childhood.
Yeah, you had a stutter, and you felt like you spent more time with animals than you did with people because you were so uncomfortable, and you've talked a lot about that. And I've seen some of your TED Talks and so forth on that. I'm curious, though, about this field of conservation and ecology. How have you seen this field change, Alan? I mean, sort of the guiding principles in this field when you started out and how those have evolved. We've touched on some of that this hour. For example, you've got all these genetic testing tools at your disposal. You're sort of rethinking this idea of wildlife corridors and whether you should move animals to a safe place and so forth. I just love your thoughts on how this whole field of wildlife conservation has changed over the long time you've been in it.
Well, it's changed in one very important way. There's been a huge paradigm shift, and I myself have had to change. Since I've been in this field 30 years, I have found myself changing with it. It went from, in the early days, feeling that we just had to lock up animals in protected areas, that the people were outside, the animals were inside, you had to make hard boundaries, and the animals you were protecting would be fine in this Bambi-like scenario of a protected forest that you could walk in and see everything, but the people were kept outside of it.
So sanctuaries, basically.
Now,
and
I felt that way. I grew up with that kind of conservation thinking, and my early career was just go out and get as many protected areas in as many places as possible. Now, protected areas are crucial because every animal has to have an inviolate home, just like our own house. But we now know that the species itself long-term won't survive just like that, just in these small, relatively small, fragmented, protected areas, that they need to leave, that the young ones do have to disperse outwards, that people, what you brought up earlier and what I was talking about earlier is crucial. Human beings, instead of being viewed as the antagonist and the problem, are the solution. They are part of the environment. We are part of the environment. So any kind of conservation model has to include the human communities and the human landscape along with the protected area. So it's not a matter of always having crisis management, some kind of crisis with people. It's got to be seen as normal perturbations. The human beings and wildlife living together with occasional conflict, mitigating that conflict, that's part of a larger model. Everything that has changed, the real paradigm shift in conservation, has been that if we're going to succeed long term, we need to be scaling up in the proper way so that conservation activities are done at true species range-wide scales, not just in little spots around the world.
That's a big rethink, isn't it?
Big, big, but it's crucial. And many of my own peers, much of the conservation world, hasn't quite come around to it as well.
Well, sure, we're so used to thinking, you know, that we can't live side by side, and there is a real fear of, being attacked. As I said, that jogger in Colorado was killed. You said the family in San Francisco had a mountain lion living underneath their porch. So, you know, it sounds great, and I hear what you're saying, but when you get on the ground, it's kind of difficult, isn't it?
Well, it is, but if you look at it in the right perspective, it's no more difficult than saying, well, I don't want to live in Boston or in New York because I know that so many thousands of people are hit by cars every year in this city, or so many numbers of people are raped and murdered in this city. You have to view it as part of what is a natural part of our culture. We try to mitigate it as much as possible. We try to bring down those numbers of bad things happening to where now New York City is considered one of the safest large cities in the United States, and yet there's still huge numbers of people dying here. But it's livable because of our mindset. We view wildlife and conservation is not usually viewed that way. It's viewed as something outside of us. Just as scientists have to realize that local communities are a part of conservation, people have to realize that wildlife are a part of our well-being and our natural world that we have to have. It's not a hobby. It's not something we just have out there to go to on a nice weekend. It's actually part of what we need for a healthy world as we start just increasing population numbers and taking more and more habitat away.
So this idea of coexistence, that's what you're talking about when your group says so many times in its materials, we need to take conservation to the next level. We need to rethink this in a new way.
That's right. I don't know why the idea of coexistence is so difficult when people say, well, they're dangerous animals. the coexistence with other human beings is much more difficult. Other human beings are much more dangerous than these cats are. And yet we realized, well, that's part of our world. We have to try to coexist. Well, it should be the same with wildlife.
Well, and Alan, my last question, and I hope you don't think it's silly given what you just said, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You said earlier you're allergic to cats, which is kind of funny. Have you ever been attacked by a wild cat? I mean, you've been out in the field for so long with these animals.
I've not been attacked. There have been a few tricky situations, but they were mostly of my doing. I mean, it's actually been opposite. Once I was actually tracking a jaguar, and I turned around after a few hours, and there was a jaguar in back of me. It had actually been following me and was tracking me for quite a while, and it could have killed me at any time. The same thing had happened with a tiger. I was tracking a tiger, and the tiger was in back of me. It had circled around and was tracking me.
Wow.
Because they're very, very curious animals. Now, there have been a couple of instances where I actually captured a jaguar and a leopard, and I drugged them in order to put a radio collar on them and do scientific research. And in one case, the jaguar woke up too early, or earlier than I thought, from the drug. The leopard, the same thing happened. They literally, the jaguar leaped up I was still trying to attach a radio collar, and it walked over my face. It knocked me down and walked over me.
More stories that I know you'll be sharing with the folks at Squam Lakes Natural Science Center. I'm going to wrap you up for today, but thank you so much for being with us. We really enjoyed it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, that's Alan Rabinowitz. For more information about his appearance in New Hampshire, go to our website, nhpr.org.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The Market Basket saga continues as thousands rally against the company's board and both sides seem entrenched. Governor Hassan calls for a hold on large expenditures after another dip in state revenues. And two New Hampshire teens compete in a world championship bagpipe competition in Scotland. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Comcast Business, continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com. And Nutrition Services Department at Huggins Hospital in Wolfboro, promoting Kids Eat Right Month with nutrition tips and ideas online at hugginshospital.org.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVU Concord.
89.1. WEVS Nashua.
88.3. WEVH Hanover.
91.3. WEVN Keene.
90.7. WEVC Gorham.
107.1. WEVJ Jackson.
99.5. WEVF Colebrook.
90.3. And WEVQ Littleton.
91.9. And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Last Saturday, residents of Toledo, Ohio, were ordered to stop drinking their tap water. The ban was lifted Monday morning, but affected 500,000 residents. The cause was a surge in a poisonous bloom of algae in Lake Erie. While harmful algae is particularly bad in Lake Erie and the Great Lakes, it's also a widespread concern across the country. Scientists believe the reasons for the increase are varied, from agricultural runoff to climate change. Environmental groups say weakened regulations are contributing to the problem. Harmful algae in the nation's water supply debate over tougher standards. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State John Kerry has arrived in Afghanistan on an unannounced visit. He's expected to talk to the country's two presidential candidates about their dispute over the country's recent runoff election. Each presidential candidate contends he won. Kerry also arrives after the shooting death of U.S. General Harold Green by an Afghan army soldier this week. A lawyer for former NSA contractor Edward Snowden says he's been granted permission to stay in Russia for another 3 years. Before he went to Moscow last year, Snowden released top-secret documents detailing U.S. intelligence had extensive spying programs used on Americans and foreign governments. Russia is banning certain fresh food imports from the U.S. and its allies. These include produce, meat, and dairy items. Russia is acting after the U.S. increased its economic sanctions against Russia for supporting pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. Reports from Sierra Leone say troops are now blockading districts in the eastern part of the country dealing with Ebola. NPR's Ophabia Quist-Arkton reports Sierra Leone's president announced the emergency measure to stop the spread of the virus.
Sierra Leone's police chief in charge of the East, Alfred Caro Camara, is quoted by local Politico newspaper and Reuters saying troops are to establish a complete